IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 86 of the Killing It Podcast. Well, we stuck the beginning anyway, so
we're starting off strong. That's always the key.
Exactly. Yes, we've got the first 8 seconds.
We were laughing. We do always warm up before we get started. You, the listener, you do not want to hear the warm up. It was. You may think you do. You think you do, but you do not. It's too unstructured, and
it is not an exercise in academic rigor where we are preparing our deep insights for the day. There's a lot of profanity. There's a certain amount of complaining about the way that things go, and jealousy about Dave's upload speeds that are way better than the rest of ours. And, you know, we
embarrassingly
exactly. high. We complain about what you complain about. We just don't bother to record that part.
I will say that I think I dropped the same amount of profanity on the podcast that I do before the podcast. I think it's really close. Almost. There might be a slight bit more. Yeah. But it's still pretty close.
As a speaker, you had to learn a long time ago, inside voice, outside voice.
Exactly. I know how to turn that on and off.
Very cool. Well, we have a very exciting show today.
We do.
And we have a sponsor.
We do. We want to thank our sponsor this week, Kazinsta's Text. Have you got headaches with customers texting your technicians? Kazinsta's Text brings your texting conversations into service tickets. Set your MSP apart by allowing your customers to communicate the way they want without losing control of the conversation. Since text messages are 10 times more likely to be opened than email, you can get your tickets to resolved faster. An essential tool for supporting a growing remote workforce. Go to tixt.us, that's T-I-X-T.us, to sign up for a free 30-day trial.
Excellent. And thank you very much, as always, to all of our sponsors and supporters. We really appreciate that. So I want to take the first topic here and dive in for today's episode. This is one of my ongoing quests to convince Dave that 3D printing is cool.
Many
of the people in the audience already believe that 3D printing is cool. Dave keeps reminding us, if you need anything at volume, there's already a way to do that. It's called China.
China.
and it does what it does for a reason. However, there are use cases, and the article that we're going to link to here for this episode, I believe, is a very interesting frontier. So the use case is 1 in 5,000 births in the US, a child is born with a condition called microtia, which causes their ear, the outer ear, to never fully develop. And there are a whole host of solutions where we have tried over the years to do that. They are prosthetics, there are clip-ons, there are external, and there are also surgical things that are tried to address this problem. It's partly for the aesthetics, the appearance. It is partly for the actual acoustic performance of the ear. There are a lot of reasons why this matters. And now there is a technique where we can bioprint using literally just the same engine for a 3D printer, but not using silicon or plastic or other kinds of media, but using a biologically compatible material and actually print an ear that is designed to fit you, that is compatible with you so that it's not going to cause any allergic reactions or whatever. This it opens up a certain set of things, the whole bio/pharma/healthcare angle of 3D printing. We spent some time over in Europe last year with a company that uses 3D printing for the application of customized medication dosing, right? Instead of take one of these or a little bit less than one, or hey, take this little tiny pill, crack it in half, and then only take a half, because everybody knows how scientifically accurate that is. Based on who you are, based on your body weight, your metabolism, whatever, there's a number of inputs. They can print your medication in a dose that is 100% optimized for you. Now, whether it is durable goods or whether it is consumable goods, the biopharma healthcare angle on 3D printing, I think is fascinating. What say you, Dave?
All right, so this is one of those bits where I'm gonna go, okay, it is the Venn diagram of use cases when 3D printing makes sense to me. And the reason is because it is incredibly highly specialized and difficult to create, right? And it is personalized. Like I always rail against 3D printing because most of the people are talking about these use cases where it's like, I'm not going to need 1,000 pens printed out on a 3D printer. It is way better to just ship that plastic over and get it created and shipped back to me. But a one-of-a-kind item that is difficult to create, but we can use a 3D printer. Yeah. Okay. This makes sense to me. I'll even argue that I don't think replacement parts in most cases make sense. Cause again, it's just easier to have a big old pile of them on the side and cheaper, but an ear, that's exactly the definition of not a shelf part I'm going to keep on there where they're all generic. Yeah. Okay.
Check mark.
Some people may already know this, but you can Google it. The way that this used to be done is that they would mold the cartilage and then stick it on the back of a mouse, and the ear would be grown on a mouse and then placed on a child. So this is a big step in the right direction. But you know what's interesting is what most people use 3D printing for is prototyping. And this is kind of the other end of the spectrum from that. This is the unique one use case. And I will say that everything in the medical field is perfect for 3D printing. I have a 3D printed tooth. It's probably 7 years old at this point. Part of it is you're moving into an area where the cost doesn't matter anymore, right? When you're mass producing pens, cost matters. When you're producing one ear for one child, it's going to cost what it's going to cost, right? When you're producing a tooth, you're competing with gold and high-end ceramics, right? So as long as you come in that range, it's going to be reasonable.
Well, right? I would be remiss if I did not point out that cost is of significantly less importance. If you were said that the cost of the new ear was, I don't know, I'm going to pull out a ridiculous number, $10 million.
Right.
Then the answer is, well, no, not so much. Thank you. but you're right where the uniqueness, this is an incredibly high value bit. Again, you're not going to put a value on someone's life from that level. I'm just saying there is a cost benefit reward, even in medicine.
Absolutely true. Where this goes. And again, this article, there's a squirrely little link in there that takes you deep down the rabbit hole of other places where bioprinting can and will make sense. The use cases are not, if I can think of one or two, there's a scientist somewhere who's thought of 1,000 or 2,000, and they go very far into the world of replacement organs and joint parts and other functional elements of the human condition. As a human who wanders around this world with a very defective disc in my back that causes lifestyle and quality of life issues, I am highly invested in a world where they can 3D print a disc that is biocompatible and exactly tuned to the definition of my personal spine, and I can just go back to good as new. Now, if you could do that with knee cartilage and with hip connectors and all of the rotator cuffs in this world, I think that there's a lot of humans who would pay you a lot of money for some 3D printing capabilities. What's remarkable is it's the same engine. That printing engine, the layered approach to, I will take a gradual build up of additive manufacturing and I will only put material where it is absolutely needed. The print driver, if you will, is the same as if we were printing Christmas ornaments, and Carl has a long wait list for his Christmas ornaments. It's the same driver.
Well, look, I'm waiting on my upgraded liver because, that's clearly what I'm going to need it for. But look, I mean, this is, again, where I'm 100% with. The interesting thing, my takeaway lesson here for everybody, making it practical, is look, you have to identify the proper use cases for these technologies. That's the important bit. Like, it's all well and good to go, oh, 3D printing is cool. There's a whole bunch of times where it just doesn't make no sense, which is why I'm the skeptic, right? Where I'm always looking, going, because every time I get pitched on these, at least it generally was these use cases where I'm like, there's just a better way to do that. Here's a clear example. Again, that Venn diagram of bits where it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. This makes sense to me. That's the lens you want to use as a good skeptic on this, to say, are we applying the technology to the right problem?
And I would just point out, you know, there are certain technologies that everybody buys into them because they look cool. And then 5 years later, they're like, a lot of people aren't using them. Think of how many scanners we sold because everybody wanted a scanner because it was so easy and so fast and da 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 da. And now most people who start up businesses, they don't have a scanner. They don't need a scanner because it turns out they don't use a scanner.
Well, that we don't use paper as much.
But right. It's like, if you need one and you use one, then by all means, it's worth the money. And I'm glad we went through that. But there was a time when literally everybody was buying scanners. And then they just sat there and gathered dust. And at some point it got unplugged and moved because you needed the desk space. And you know, so 3D printing has its place. And I think that we are solidly in the era of, if you need it, we're now at the point where they're affordable and you can use them for various things, whether it's manufacturing or pharmaceuticals or whatever. But it's no longer quite cutting edge technology. It's now just good established technology trying to figure out where it makes sense and where it doesn't.
Well, that's a whole other topic that I think we'll wrap this up by alluding to the fact that there's a lot of things that we almost consider emerging technologies that just aren't anymore, that are way more mainstream for a lot of reasons. But that is a topic for another day. And instead, I want to bring up an article highlighting an MIT analysis of Reddit using AI. Now, what the headline focuses on showing the high levels or sky high levels of anxiety across the pandemic. Now, this is what they did is they ran a bunch of subreddits through the algorithms to try and assess where they're at. And they did an analysis and they just showed like significant rises in anxiety and suicide risk levels. What was interesting to me about this particular article was we've talked a lot about AI and bias and AI and application. Here is one of those bits where it's like, okay, we actually are using it to understand what the bias or what the mood is and then use that for better informed decisions. It's one thing to go out and poll a group of people and say, how are you feeling? It's a whole other analysis to say, we're just going to go look at the writings of all of these various people and then be able to say how people are feeling based on that. That for me was the real takeaway here was this is a really different way of understanding sentiment. It's understanding, you know, if you can think about it from a commercial sense, customer sentiment, like how your customers feel, analyzing the way consumption is done. And that's what jumped out at me.
I think one of the most interesting pieces about this is, and they don't really talk about it in the article, but somebody must have figured out which combinations of words and phrases reflect depression and suicide and, you know, other kinds of things. And, you know, we already have quite a bit of analysis of how people respond to voice commands on a telephone answering machine, right? That, you know, you call and they're like, push one for this and two for that. And if you just scream into the phone, give me the blah, 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 guess what? You get an operator right away, you know, because they know that you're so pissed off, right? And that's not true in every case, but it's true in cases where you're paying high money, you know, like the helplines at the airport for the platinum flyers. But, you know, we can analyze lots of things if we know what we're looking for, but somebody's still got to first figure out what are those phrases that we can then analyze. And separate question of whether Reddit's the place to do that.
Well, yeah, because my question is, which is more likely, that Reddit is a place where you can analyze whether or not people are stressed out, or is Reddit a place where stressed out people go? Because quite frankly, if anybody claims to use science to understand Reddit, they're the first ones, right? Like, it is definitely a place where you can get a variety of content that can be analyzed. I think, Dave, where you're going is it's the practical application. It's the lie detector test, but for a modern age. And I'm not suggesting that we're measuring people lying, but lie detector tests are based on co-indicators of dishonesty, right? They're not measuring whether or not you're dishonest. They're measuring your pulse. They're measuring the moisture on your finger. They're measuring undeniable bioindicators that they have determined meet a profile. Well, that's an algorithm, right? That is what they are doing. And if you can put the brain power into constructing the analysis to get an accurate assessment of what condition is being done, and then you apply supercomputing to it so that you do it in volume, at pace, as close to real time as possible, well, that's how a robot will eventually become human-ish, right? Like where they will be able to read your tone of voice and look at your body posture and react accordingly. Now, I believe we're dozens of years away from anything that's not just as creepy as possible to try and approximate that. Again, look at that video of the Disney robot that we mentioned last week. If you've not seen it, that's creepy. It's nowhere near human-like, but this is how you get from here to there. By the way, to the degree that you can identify populations that are feeling unnaturally high levels of anxiety and then use your regular non-technology methods to respond to that at a population level, that's a really, really good idea. Just the sensor control to identify where people are freaking out and what they are freaking out about, and then use public health methodology to fix that. And I say public, that could be a group of a million people, that could be a group of a dozen people. If you can analyze the group dynamics and identify that kind of stress, that sensor is incredibly valuable, but it's just the beginning.
See, the other thing I liked about this is the ability to go where people are, right? So if you think about this, and I'm going to think about polling and public sentiment in a very generic term, coming off a particular time of polling, that's not where I'm going with this. What I'm saying is that, like, the point of any kind of polling in any realm is to try and understand customer sentiment. That's a nice way of saying it. Like, what it is a different act to go and proactively, like, interview someone and ask them questions versus an analysis like this. You know, Reddit actually, in many cases, depending on the community itself, can be a very, very positive experience for those using it, or it can be very moderated. You can have very positive discussion, or as they found in many of the mental health or personal finance, like, you can actually get very, very accurate information about people and sentiment. And you do it in a way that doesn't bias the study simply by asking, like by whether or not you're willing to admit something or where you're willing to be open to it. So it can be significantly more accurate. I put this in the category of, like, it is one more tool in the toolbox. It isn't necessarily a matter of that, hey, we're replacing one. No, we can have our insights be better because we can get from multiple sources. We may still ask customers, for example, what they think, but we can also go out and survey sentiment with something like this and get information back.
Well, the scientific principle is what you measure, you alter. Because it's unnatural that somebody stopped and made and asked you a question, you have to stop and go, I don't know, how would I answer that question? If they're just observing you, that's radically more natural and accurate.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that this was done by MIT, right? Because yes. I know that they did it over time, so they saw the difference in how people were posting and the language they used and so forth. I think it's interesting to speculate, and I always enjoy stuff like this to make it as complicated as possible, because that's where the understanding comes from. Are you merely observing the same people changing their language, or are more people choosing to join into these conversations because they're feeling stress, right? One of the things that forums have always been good for online is, I suddenly have a problem, there's a place I can go and talk about it with complete strangers. And, you know, kind of, we've all used Yahoo groups instead of going to, you know, paying for a therapist, right? So Reddit is just one of those places where people go. And so it'd be interesting to do follow-up and see, was it the same people making this conversation, or is it a broader audience that has chosen to go there and express themselves?
Well, and of course, over time, you can track that kind of thing. I'm sure the researchers are thinking about that. Again, it's a very data-driven approach to this kind of analysis. And for me, that was the big thing where I was like, okay, loving this, because that's hitting all my buttons on the way that I like to approach this problem.
Very cool. All right. More fun stuff. So we covered AI. One of the other things that we cover from time to time is facial recognition. And as we've talked about several times on this program, sometimes facial recognition has the problem that it has some built-in biases, that it over-identifies certain races. And part of that has to do with the way that it's been programmed. So, shocker, it turns out that some folks in the Detroit City Council have decided, rather than throw it away, why don't we see if we can fix it? And one, James Tate, one specific member of the Detroit City Council, is calling on the police to say, hey, go and tune it up. You know, we're going to approve renewing your contract, but what we want you to do is to fix it, make it better and improve it, which I think is a much better step than throwing it away. First of all, there are certain things, and facial recognition is one of them. I think you have to accept it's not going away. So it doesn't make any sense to fight against it. It's much better to have an approach of saying, hey, why don't we see if we can fine tune this, knowing that we're going to go through a period where we're in the process of fixing it. And so we have to be very hyper aware of the biases that are built into that system.
Well, one of the challenges with humans doing that work, right? Us recognizing faces, is that, you know, we can be very contextual in a positive sense, but we tend to bring our biases with us. And then obviously we take our biases and we plug them into this technology. The difference between an algorithm for facial recognition and a human is that you can fundamentally upgrade the algorithm, right? Like, now those of us that come with our years of experience and our life point of view, we can give you sensitivity training and we can educate you and we can make you aware of the things that you are, your logical fallacies that you are applying to your world. But that doesn't mean you're ever going to abandon those logical fallacies. This is a brilliant application of a little bit of just sober logic applied to what can be an out of control technology. You can always unplug the old algorithm and upgrade it with better definitions, with more sensitivity, with less bias. And that same equipment can now perform its function without the negative application. That's the good news about algorithm driven technologies. You can turn off the algorithm and turn on a new one.
Well, so what's interesting to me, the pushback on this came from the fact that to a certain degree, my sense of what was going on was just aggressive rollout of the technology without a lot of real thought and understanding of the implication, nor of the biases. And I think it was a little bit too much trusting that the algorithms are great. It just works. It does what it says on the tin. Like, that's for me where the pushback comes. And so I'm not surprised that there is a tech lash to this and there has been pushback to it. I am of the opinion, much like the city council person, that, okay, yeah, I agree. Like, I want to test these things. Where my concern is when I need it to go deeper than just saying that. I need to go deeper into actually understanding, okay, what are the checks and the tests that you're putting into place to ensure that it is done right, you know, and you know, we often take the approach of a trust but verify. In some cases, you know, trust may be too strong and the verify needs to be a little bit more intense. I think, you know, and we're not a political podcast, but I think, you know, we can agree systems need to be examined, particularly when you're talking about policing. You know, there is, assuming the system is functioning exactly right, and then they will test, is probably a flawed assumption. You probably need to understand that you're going to need to assume that the system may not be correct on multiple levels. And so your but verify of trust but verify really needs to be very strong and very deliberate. I'm for the idea of the testing to make but verify work, but I'm concerned that there might not be enough of that in what they're talking about.
Well, and I think I'm sorry, Carl, you go.
No, just the Detroit, you know, police force, part of what they did is they said, look, we're going to put in a citizen overview committee. We're going to make sure that we only use this for very serious crimes. We're going to make sure that there are multiple approvals of the software before it's used for certain things, right? So they put some, what I guess you would almost say are common sense guards in place that probably should have been there from the beginning instead of, you know, because what probably happened was somebody went to a trade show, they saw this amazing thing and they said, here's a Citi credit card. We'll take one of those.
Yeah, and I'd like to buy me one of them facial recognitions.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, I mean, look, there's a particular quote in here. You know, the fine print about the limits of facial recognition technology is sometimes overlooked. Well, the fine print's there for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, and I will say, Dave, I think you hit it square on the head here, because there is a presumption of authority, and any technology in security and or law enforcement is given that umbrella perception of, well, this is an authority figure using a tool for that purpose. And yet, anybody who's been through an airport at any point in the past 10 years knows you have been randomly selected for further screening is one of the silliest statements that needs to be said out loud. No, it wasn't random. And we know what the criteria usually are, because that's the way that the tools get used by the people who are using those tools. In this case, I think that there is a tremendous level of invested credibility of, well, I need it to recognize the faces. They told me it would recognize the faces in this highly charged, valuable situation. Therefore, of course it is fine and everything that it spits out is accurate. No, it's not. The metal detector at the airport makes mistakes. The scanning belt at the airport makes mistakes. The stand there with your hands above your head thing makes mistakes. So does this. You cannot assume that the technology, especially in a version 1.0, is going to be advanced and functional. It has to be upgraded, and not just by the people who sell it. Because
well, and remember, it's the technology. Your example is a great one for people to think about. Like, you know, the way you describe it is almost the single instance, right? But I can have the same technology deployed in multiple locations and get different results. I mean, right. I always laugh and go like, so I, you know, over the past 10 years, I've done more than 1 million miles of flying. For the longest time, you know, there was one item in my briefcase that only got flagged in Frankfurt. Like I didn't change. My briefcase didn't change. What changed was the particular implementation and the humans running it, right? And so you got different results in different places. You know, I always laugh and go like, you know, I have been most stopped in Frankfurt and second most stopped in Heathrow. I didn't change.
You know, well, but you know, it's also the case, because all of us have been frequent flyers, you know, that if you go through the run-of-the-mill line, that you're going to get more metal detected than if you go through the line for the clear, right? Yes. If you have TSA pre-check, they have cranked that thing way down. I mean, that's just the way it is. Same equipment, right? Two different uses. And that's the way it is. So I can totally see a defense in court of saying, hey, we were prosecuted by this technology, which is version 2.471, and you know, they in version, you know, 3.0, they fixed all of these problems with bias. And so, you know, you got to let me go.
not that I have any recent experience with this, knock on wood, but that's why you actually, the you can actually go to court for a speeding ticket. Yes, he had a radar gun. Yes, it measured you going more than what you should have been. But was he using it properly? Was it recently calibrated? That is a living technology that we have to work with. Anything that's going to have instantaneous judgment and authority associated with it, please let's not use 1.0 algorithms.
Let me just say, Ryan, that defense never works. I tried, that doesn't work.
I have been there many, many times. Very good. Well, hey, we want your feedback. So if you love us, you hate us, you agree with us, you disagree with us, whatever, put your comments in, send us a note. And in the meantime, I think that will do it for episode 86 of the Killing It podcast. See, I can do it.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.